The World's Yearling Sale. Make plans for the Keeneland September Yearling Sale, September 13th through the 24th. Visit theworldsyearlingsale.com to learn more.
Good morning. It is 9:32 Wednesday, September 15th. This is the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, and I can't put my finger on it. Something seems different about John this week.
You know, I was just going to say that, Joe. Hi, I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent from Thoroughbred Daily News. And we're very pleased to welcome Gabby Gaudette to join us in the writer's room. At the same time, and don't you ever tell him I said this. I actually kind of miss the guy, the big lunk, John Green, huh?
You're right.
Well, I know I have big shoes to fill, definitely, this week, but happy to be on the podcast. Gabby Gaudette here. You've seen me on TVG, Keeneland as well, and also co-host of the new TDN podcast, Let's Talk. One episode down, many, many more to go, but happy to be on with you guys. Although I'm not a writer, so this feels a little bit out of my element. You're not going to ask John for that, right?
Neither is John Green, for that matter.
Yeah, John's so not a writer either. So you fit in perfectly in that seat.
Perfect.
The TDN Writers Room is presented by Keeneland, home of the World's Yearling Sale. If you haven't noticed, the Keeneland September Yearling Sale is in full swing. Lots of action. We're going to get to it in the first couple of days. Make plans to attend the Keeneland September Yearling Sale, which goes through next Friday, September 24th, and you can view the catalog at theworldsyearlingsale.com. So we're thrilled to have Gabby on this week. She is a Keeneland expert, both on the sales and the racing side. Keeneland September kicked off, as I mentioned, on Monday. We've gotten through book one, both sessions of book one. Lots of action. I believe 30 horses that were $750,000 and up. A bunch of million-dollar yearlings. There were three the first day. There were six or seven yesterday. So the action has really picked up through the end of book one. Book two starts tomorrow, I believe, after today's dark day. I'm going to toss it to Gabby mostly for this because she knows a lot more than me. She's on the ground. She's at Keeneland. To me, one of the overarching themes and one of the things that I noticed early was Justify and how popular Justify is. And you would expect that with a Triple Crown winner, but he's got, I mean, it seems like every horse that comes in the ring does a huge bidding war for him. And it's really exciting to now think about seeing his horses on the track next year as two-year-olds. And I'm really excited for him in particular because he's the son of Scat Daddy. You know, Scat Daddy was going to be, he was already a superstar sire. He was probably going to be a legendary generational sire. Unfortunately, we lost him too early. So I'm really excited to see him carry the flag for Scat Daddy going forward. And I think that's one of the reasons that he's so popular. You know, I think people want that son of Scat Daddy early on. No Nay Never is one of the ones I think of that he already has at stud that's gotten really, really popular. He's at Coolmore in Ireland. He started at 25,000 euros a couple of years ago. He's already up to 150,000 euros for his stud fee. So I think that's a big part of it. Obviously, the Triple Crown thing is very attractive for people. But, you know, these are basically just very, very novice layman's observations. Gabby has the real scoop and has been there. What have been your impressions from the first 2 days, Gabby?
Oh, obviously prep for the Keeneland September sale starts as soon as the book comes out for me in the catalog. And kind of going back to that, you know, when I was looking at the pedigrees, you see a lot of Justifies. So obviously we've seen a lot of people have confidence in breeding to him from the get-go. That's why we see them show up in book one, but also the physicals. I mean, these horses are absolutely gorgeous. So I think that's what's been really attractive to buyers so far. But on top of that, we've seen a lot of people come to the sale this year with the intention of buying those classic pedigrees. And obviously we see that with Justify, him being a Triple Crown winner, you know, BSW Bloodstock, they have a new Colts partnership, obviously the other partnerships that have been active in years past as well, but really paying attention to those classic pedigrees. And even the presence of people like Hideyuki Mori, you know, who are he's taking several of his Justifies back to Japan, even mentioned that he thought that they would run well on the turf in Japan. So I think Justify is just hitting many different markets. He's I think he's going to wind up being a pretty versatile stallion, as many of these buyers think. But overall, just the first two sessions of book one, yeah, they've been strong. And it's been encouraging to see some new buyers be in the marketplace as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that I noticed as well. I just want to correct myself. The dark day is Friday. They move around the dark days a little bit. We got book two starting today, and then we have book two.
Yeah. Joe, not to interrupt you, but yeah, I mean, it's the schedule, the format has completely changed this year. And so we had 2 days of book one, 2 days of book two, which begins Wednesday, Thursday. The first dark day is going to be on Friday. Book three starts on Saturday. And, you know, the new sales team, everybody at Keeneland has incorporated new things this year, including the reoffering of RNAs, which, you know, horses that did not sell on Monday came back and sold on Tuesday evening. Some of them did. So yeah, there have been a lot of changes just to add to all the layers of this year's sale.
Yeah, we're going to talk to Shannon Arvin, the CEO of Keeneland, a little bit about the sale and what have been the early trends and her early impressions as well. But there was a lot of diversity in terms of sire power at the top of the list the first couple of days, and buying power. I think Gabby makes a good point that there are a lot of people that are there this year. I mean, you can confirm this, that are there this year that weren't as involved last year. And, you know, just because of COVID, I think it interrupted the sales season enough that people either sent their representatives or sat it out a little bit more than they normally would. But yeah, this year there's a lot of international interest. You mentioned Hideyuki Mori, who's there. Winchell Thoroughbreds got involved the other day. Got a $1.35 million son of Into Mischief. Ron Winchell said he's been trying to get an Into Mischief that runs well for a while now and hasn't been able to find one. So he really went to the mat for that one. Whisper Hill Farm got involved with Tappet yesterday. You know, Mandy Pope loves Tappet. Got a $1.3 million son of Tappet. Just looking at the rest of the buyers, Mayberry Farm, Cortland Farm, Seahorse Stables, Spendthrift, Coolmore. So really a lot of diversity at the top of the sale. And it's been really exciting. And I think, you know, Gabby, you can speak to this, but how has the feeling been on the grounds in terms of energy as compared to last year?
Completely different, and for obvious reasons. I mean, there are a lot of people that were bidding online last year that just couldn't make it to the sale physically. And, you know, I think a lot of the international buyers have tried their best to come here to Keeneland. They really, really, really want to be here. Obviously, it's extremely difficult, but Keeneland has worked with them and vice versa to try to just get some of these international buyers on the grounds. But yeah, I would say the energy is completely different than last year. I think people just didn't really know what to do last year, right? It was something that We were developing COVID protocols and procedures, and everything just kind of came together in September last year. But this year, it seems like we have a really good blueprint, and we're building off of that and just making things a little bit more accessible to buyers just all around. But yeah, even China Horse Club, you know, they have a presence here. I was talking to Tio a couple of days ago, and he was really upset that he wasn't able to be at Keeneland physically last year and was so excited. Like, he kept on saying it over and over again, I'm so excited to physically be here this year. And obviously they've had a big sale so far, not only from a buying standpoint, but also a selling standpoint as well. So it's just good to see some of those familiar faces back, but also the international people coming in and the new buyers. You mentioned Jim and Dana Bernhard. They're new. I mean, they're new to purchasing yearlings at the September sale, and they came in hot with $1 million horse. And they're really, really nice folks from Louisiana. So it's been nice to see some of those new faces as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is just my opinion, but we talked last week about how many great performances there were at Saratoga. It really was an explosive summer in terms of 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, sprinters, classic horses. I just felt like there were a ton of really exciting performances. And I think Keeneland September is always the beneficiary of being right after Saratoga, because everybody's so excited about all the horses that they've seen on those big stages run those huge races. And I feel like that's just even more pronounced this year because Saratoga was such a great meet with so many explosive performances. And now that everybody's able to be back and at Keeneland, yeah, I mean, I imagine the buzz is through the roof, and it's been exciting the first couple of days. So yeah, like I said, book two starts today and tomorrow, and then the dark day is Friday, and then the sale runs through next Friday. And like I said, we're going to talk to Shannon Arvin in a little bit about all the action. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Spendthrift Farms. Spendthrift had a successful book one at Keeneland. Yesterday, they landed Hit 356, and then to Miss Your Filly out of grade one winner Embellish the Lace. I remember her winning the Alabama for the Leblancs for $1.25 million, and also Into Mischief yesterday became the first stallion to sire 3 yearlings to bring over $1 million in the sales ring in 2021. We've already gone on at length about how Into Mischief is unrivaled in the sales space and on the racetrack. We also had a colt that I mentioned before go for $1.35 million to Winchell Thoroughbreds on Monday. And there'll be a good number of yearlings by the popular first crop sire, Bolt Doro. We've talked about him as well and how well received his yearlings have been even this early in the process. There's a bunch of yearlings by him in books 2 and 3 coming up. So we can look forward to talking about his results in the Keeneland sales ring next week. Owning potential future superstars like Flightline is attainable with a racing partnership with West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So obviously West Point was very busy during book one of Keeneland. They got in on several high class yearlings, including the current sale topper, Stone Street Bred Quality Road, half brother to Midnight Bourbon. Terry Finley said following the sale that the colt was purchased in partnership with Woodford Racing for $1.6 million. And that Stone Street also stayed in for a piece of the horse. So that's always nice when you see the breeders stay in. It shows a lot of confidence. He said the horse is going to go to Shug McGahee, who obviously trains First Captain, who's a nice 3-year-old for West Point. And they also purchased the Medallia Doro colt for $575,000 and partnered up on a Quality Road colt for $510,000 and a $310,000 Malibu Moon filly. So lots of action for West Point across the board. You know, they got good eyes for talent over there, and obviously they're making more and more splashes at all these sales. And like I said, currently have the sale topper, and I'm sure they're going to get involved much more as well in book two coming up. So it was not a huge weekend racing wise here. There was a lot of action overseas that we're going to get to in a little bit. But I thought the big story of the weekend was Kentucky Downs and those 5 graded stakes on Saturday. You know, I think Kentucky Downs really shows, you know, I don't know if I'm sure you guys have seen a Field of Dreams and the famous line, if you build it, they will come. And that's kind of how I feel about Kentucky Downs, that if you give people big fields and low takeout and you put up lots of purse money, the bettors and the owners will reward you. And obviously it's easier to do with a small 6 or 7 day meet. It's not as easy to do if you're running an entire season. But in general, I think they do things the right way, and they've been rewarded for it. The handle numbers came out from this meet, over $74 million in handle, which is, for 6 days, that's a gigantic, gigantic number. Smashed their old record, which was $59.8 million. So I think, you know, and Saturday, which was the featured day of the meet, the 11-race Calumet Turf Cup card, they handled over $20 million, which smashed, again, the former mark of $17.4 million. You had Ron Winchell on a couple weeks ago to talk about it. And he just talked about the growth of the Kentucky Downs meet and how much more popular it's become. But it takes vision. It takes vision to invest resources into that meet being such a short meet and to make it a marquee place for bettors and for owners. And I think that's really what they've done. I you know, with all the money they've given away, we talked about this with John, that the O'Briens are starting to look a little bit more at running horses at Kentucky Downs. I think the bettors have always, you know, received it well. But I think especially now with the higher quality of fields, you know, pretty much every race is an allowance, maiden special or a stake. There are very few claiming races left. I think it's really become a place for people to I don't know, get their leftover buzz from Saratoga satisfied, because it is just absolutely terrific racing and they deserve all the success that's coming to them. And like I said, can we get them a grade one? Can the American Grade Stakes Committee give them a grade one? I don't care which it is. Just one of them, give them a grade one race. We really enjoy it. But let's hear from Bill and Gabby about their.
I would also say, can we get these $600,000 ungraded races to at least be grade threes? And Joe, yeah, the story of Kentucky Downs was not so much what happened on the racetrack. And there's some very good performances. Maybe in a little bit, we'll talk about how Arklow probably would have won the $1 million race if not getting into a ton of trouble.
Well, how about Joel Rosario?
Joel Rosario in the meet that he had, 17 winners to just obliterate the record. The 12 was the previous record. But, you know, the story is, it has been every preceding year, is what's going on from the business standpoint. And you gave the numbers out, and these are sensational numbers. This is not for Saratoga or for Del Mar. This is for a little obscure race that happens in the middle of a field in rural Kentucky on the Tennessee border. And the thing about it is, I don't think they're even close to peaking, because what's happening here is everybody now is, it's not just Saratoga, Del Mar, Keeneland. I think it's now Saratoga, Del Mar, Keeneland, Kentucky Downs. The horse players are circling on their calendars. And why would you? You know, there's two facets that go into a good betting product. Number one is low takeout. Actually, I would say three: low takeout, big fields, and quality racing. And they get an A+ mark in all three categories. I think, you know, we talked about a $20 million handle on that Saturday. I think in 2 or 3 years we'll be talking about a $30 million handle on that Saturday. And yeah, I mean, they really absolutely do things right there. And you know, it's. If anyone, you know, these racetracks out there that are kind of struggling, well, you know, if you're running five horse fields and you got a 24% takeout on your exactas, well, you know what? Kentucky Downs is showing you why you're struggling, because that is a formula that is just not going to work. So, you know, we pat them on the back a lot on this show and elsewhere, and boy, do they deserve it.
Yeah. And I will say the one thing that I really appreciate about Kentucky Downs, and again, I was on site there this year. I was there last year as well, but prior to, I had never been there before. And like you guys said, it's just a field out in the middle of absolutely nowhere. It seems like Kentucky Downs, what I think is the most important thing about their product is every year they kind of regroup, they speak about what went wrong, what could have gone right, how do we improve this product for next year? And they actually take steps to go ahead and improve that product. I mean, if you look at the simulcast product, that's been improved. If you look at the purse structure, that's been improved. Even something so simple as the removable rail settings, right? I mean, they just established the 40-foot rail, 20-foot rail, and then, you know, obviously you can take it down. So there's three different rail settings as well. They added new sod to the turf course just to make it a little bit more safe and, just better for the horses in general. They've added things to the actual experience of being at Kentucky Downs, especially for the owner. So it's not only, you know, the obvious things. When you actually go there, you can see it just progressing from year to year to year, and they actually care. And sometimes we don't see that happen at racetracks in North America racing.
Yeah. And yeah, like you said, what's satisfying about it and what's satisfying about seeing them do so well from a business standpoint is that, like you say, they really think about everything they do. They think about the improvements that they're going to make year by year. So there's been, you can see the planning and the process that's gotten the meat to this point. And that makes it satisfying, and it's really deserved success. And yeah, I've always circled it on my calendar as a horse player, as Bill says. But it's even more important now because of the improvements that they've made. And even just from a presentation standpoint, it used to be very hard to watch those races and to follow those horses around that sweeping turn. They've put new cameras in and HD cameras. And the presentation is much more palatable for a racing fan or for a horse player. So I think even just little stuff like that, you know, I like to shout out tracks, small tracks like Indiana Grand has HD racing now and drone shots. And it's just the presentation is way better. And that stuff matters. You know, if it's impossible to watch a race, like I don't want to throw anybody under the bus here, but if you watch turf racing at Ellis Park this summer, it was very, very difficult to follow, you know, and I don't know.
What did Dramamine?
Yeah.
What's going on with this camera?
I felt like I was drunk watching turf races there because it was just snapping back and forth, and it was almost impossible to follow. So I don't know what the deal is with that. They got to get that sorted out. But that's kind of how it used to be watching Kentucky Downs races. And it's way easier to follow now. And I think, you know, the fans and the horse players have rewarded them for, you know, putting them first. You know, obviously all the purse money is great for the owners, but I also think that that's a track, and the management of that track has put horse players first as well. And that's not necessarily the case at most tracks in America. So yeah, like I said, if you build it, they will come, and the bettors have rewarded Kentucky Downs. And I hope that it continues to expand. Obviously it's never going to become a full meet. It's always going to be a boutique meet. But I think they can fit another day or two. And like I said, get them a grade one or two because they deserve it. The other action over the weekend was overseas. There was a ton of, you know, kind of ARC preview day action. Some of the biggest horses that ran, I mean, the biggest horse that ran actually lost on Sunday. I was really looking forward to seeing Snowfall one. She was a one run. She was a 1-5 favorite in the pre-Vermeil, which is now it's kind of weird that Aidan O'Brien still hasn't won that race, because this was supposed to be the one that checked that off for him. And she lost to Tiona, who was trained by Roger Varian, lost by a length and a half, just didn't seem to have that pickup that she usually does, where she just blows away these fields and devastates them. So that was a little bit disappointing. I wonder what's going to happen with her now, whether or not she's going to still go to the ARC or maybe come over for the Breeders' Cup. But, you know, she's obviously still appointment viewing wherever she runs next. And St. Mark's Basilica picking up another Group 1 in a very, very nice race against Tarnawa, who was second, and Poetic Flair was in there as well. He's now won Group 1s in Britain, Ireland, and France, I believe, which is not an easy thing to do. So there was a lot of good action overseas. I kind of wish we had Kelsey here this week in addition to kind of, you know, save me from stumbling my way through the European report. But there was a lot of good stuff. And I wanted to mention Hurricane Lane as well, who won the St. Ledger. That was a big win for Frankel. He and St. Mark's Basilica are now the 24th and 25th horses to have won group races in Britain, Ireland, and France in the same year in the past 50 years. So that's a pretty amazing stat. And obviously it was still a great weekend for Aidan O'Brien, but I'm sure he was very disappointed. And Snowfall not getting it done, but she's still a three-year-old filly. She's still got improvement to come, I believe. And I'm excited to see where she shows up next. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The Green Group guest of the week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we were beyond thrilled this week that she made time for us in the middle of Keeneland September. The president and CEO of Keeneland, Shannon Arvin, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you all this morning.
Yeah, and we're very excited to have you. Like I said, we appreciate you making the time to talk to us. We know it's a very busy time for you. So this is your first Keeneland September sale officially as president and CEO. You were president-elect last year, so obviously you were in charge then, but this is your first official one running the show. How has it felt? Has it felt a little bit different, or are you just so steeped in Keeneland stuff right now that it's been a smooth transition?
Oh, it's felt really different, but it's been really, really exciting. I'm so excited and thrilled about the team we have assembled here. And it's Tony Lacey's first sale, our new VP of sales, and Cormac Brannick's first sale, our new director of sales operations, who's following in the very large footsteps of our friend Jeffrey Russell. So it's exciting. Everybody was I think we had a lot of pent up energy and we were really excited to get started on Monday afternoon.
So what is just your general reactions to the first 2 days? We were talking to Gabby about it before, about how it seems like the energy is through the roof there and almost everybody's back. What have been your general impressions from the first 2 days?
Definitely. I mean, the word that we keep saying is electric. We've worked really hard to try to create the right environment that book one of September deserves. So we've got a lot of flowers. People are teasing me about a woman's touch, but I really do think flowers elevate a room. We've got flowers. We've had cocktails being passed around in the morning, brunch being passed around. The barns are full of people, domestic buyers, international buyers. And actually, when the sale started on Monday, I looked in the sales pavilion and I said, no, I don't think this is just a difference because of COVID. There were a lot of people sitting in that pavilion and really excited to be here. The electricity is palpable and we really do have that hustle and bustle back, which is what we want at a public auction.
Shannon, thanks for joining us. The numbers are in and it's a little hard to compare 2021 to 2020 because of COVID, obviously. Nonetheless, numbers are good, but let's take a broader view and maybe look at the 2021 book numbers versus 2019, 2018, 2017. And, you know, overall, what is going on? And I think the bottom line is good news. And what does that say for the industry?
You know, we had 11 horses sell for seven figures and cumulatively in book one, and looking at the median numbers and comparing them to 2019, 2018, which were really strong years, we're about there. The median from session two of book one was about 400,000, and that's about as high as it's been in recent memory, and cumulatively, it's about 355, which is really strong. So we are seeing lots of fireworks. It's just consistent. It's just from the first hip through the ring, through the end, the battle is on. There are a lot of people I know that got shut out, that were frustrated, who are going to be heavy shopping for book two and beyond. So overall, we're really excited about what it shows about the market and the strength of the market and the solidity. I mean, we feel good about where we're headed.
Shannon, there have been some changes to the book one, obviously book two of the sale this year. Dark day, first day is on Friday. But I just wanted, because of this new team that's in place with Tony and Cormac as well, what has that process been like? What were those conversations like with both the buyers and the sellers? How did you guys all land on this new format and just all the changes that have been incorporated in this year's sale?
I would say first, it's a lesson of love. And I think Tony had gray hair when he came, but it may be a little bit grayer now after that process, because entries were really already in. And then it was a matter of putting the jigsaw puzzle together. And there aren't many sales companies, any sales companies, that try to sell 4,000 horses and put that together with the stabling and try to make people happy with their placements. So we really believe in the importance of week one. And we wanted to get enough horses in front of the buyers before the break on the dark day to make buyers feel like it was worth their time to be here. But at the same time, not make it too hard on sellers and try not to have consigners in three different places in the barn. So there's been a lot of give and take. We have worked really closely communicating with consigners, and that's been really key and helpful. At the end of the day, that's what we've got to do. We've got to all work together to put on the best show we can and the best offering for our buyers. Everybody has a different view of what the format should be for September. Everybody. I mean, there were very few consistencies, but the one consistency we heard over and over with all the people we talked to was that they want consistency year to year in the format. And, you know, we actually initially thought we could have a 3-day book one, but we didn't have enough sellers to support a 3-day book one. So that's when we moved. At one point there, it was a 1-day book one and a 2-day book two. And we said, no, that's not enough before the break. So I really like this format. We do plan to work to stick with this format and let people count on it and depend on it year to year. And I think that'll really help build confidence in what we've got in September.
I wanted to ask a little bit about your background, because you're a Lexington native. You know, Keeneland is really in your blood. You have a family history at Keeneland. So kind of take us through growing up in Lexington and going to Keeneland. Take us through some of your early memories of Keeneland, not just the sale of the racing, but the culture of Keeneland, and maybe how that sets you on this path to end up being the president and CEO of the company.
Yeah, it's funny. Since I've been in the spot, a lot of people say, well, of course you were going to be president of Keeneland. Nobody ever knows you're going to be president of Keeneland. I mean, there are so many people that revere this institution and what it means to racing, what it means to the thoroughbred industry, what it means to our community. And I definitely am one of those. My grandfather was the first general manager, and he was here from 1936 until 1971. I was born in 74. So I have memories of talking to my grandfather about Keeneland, but he was at Oaklawn by the time that I was born and was around. My dad grew up on these grounds and was lawyer to Keeneland and was one of our three trustees when he passed away in 2008. So we definitely do have that reverence for how important this place is. My early memories are working here. I answered the switchboard and I worked in the sales office, and they had Dough Daddy donuts every Saturday and graham crackers and peanut butter in the break room that until COVID, I'm pretty sure were still there. I hope they weren't the same graham crackers, but I wonder sometimes. But it's just, it's a special place. And I think working with Keeneland as counsel for nearly 20 years also gave me a real appreciation for what we need to be and what we owe to the industry. I mean, we are a company that was formed by horsemen for horsemen. And in order to fulfill our mission to be a model racetrack and promote the best in thoroughbred racing and an industry world-leading sales company, we have to have horsemen on our team that understand what our customers are going through. So I think that's helped me really have strong ideas about who we need to have here. I think everybody here is so on the same page in terms of we're here for the right reasons. We all feel like we're part of something bigger than ourselves, and that's what really drives us every day. So to leave Keeneland better than we found it.
Shannon, during the week, the numbers for the fall crop came out, and they weren't good, as we know, 18,700, the lowest, that's projection, the lowest since 1965. A two-part question. How does this impact Keeneland or any sales company? And I know there's no easy answer to this, but you know, clearly this is something that's got to be of great concern to all facets of the industry. What can be done to reverse this trend?
We think about a lot. We talk about it a lot. We've looked at the data over the past 30 years as we've seen the full crop decline. It's interesting. It's just in the past 2 years that we've seen our entries at the sales start to be lower, which you would think it would follow the same trend, but it really hasn't. But we're starting to see that the full crop may be impacting our sales numbers. And you have to think logically that ultimately it will. And I think what we can do about it is to make racing better, to make racing better. And I think HISA is a huge step forward in that direction. I think the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act is a complete game changer. We have to build public confidence in our sport. I don't know any professional sports that don't have some central governing authority so people are playing by the same rules. We've got to have that. And once that's in place and as it's getting put in place, we're constantly thinking of ideas to bring new owners and fans to the sport. I've said to a couple people, you know, for 20 years you hear and you go to these meetings and they say, we're dying. I'm so ready to change that dialogue. We don't want to be dying anymore. We want to be thriving, and we're working on innovative and new ways to try to make that happen.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Shannon, and just kind of changing the perception of it as well. But just to go back to some of the new things, I was speaking to Tony a couple of days ago about the new incentive for the 2021 September grads and the cooperation with Kentucky Downs, and that there's going to be two new races next year for the two-year-old grads. What are some other things that might be in the pipeline, not only for the September sale, but also for the upcoming race meet?
We were really excited about our partnership, our venture with Kentucky Downs. We've been working with them on some other projects as well. And it's great to have people in the sport owning tracks who love racing. And Ron Winchell is definitely one of those folks that loves racing. Gatewood has done a lot of work on our race schedule to be sure that we've got races programmed and scheduled in the right way, where it's going to be most attractive to gamblers. We've seen that drive our handle, and I think we'll continue to see that. We've got two new stakes races that we've created this fall, the Bowman Mill and the Myrtlewood. So that's exciting as well. And we're just really trying to think, you know, he's rearranged the fall. Sometimes I think we've all felt like Fall Stars weekend at Keeneland is fabulous. And then by the time you get to the last weekend, you're thinking, oh, I wish it were Fall Stars weekend again. So we've saved some of that juice for the end. So it's evenly distributed and works well for horsemen. And again, that's another benefit of having a horseman here who's been a bloodstock agent and been an assistant trainer and been a jockey's agent and really understands the nuances of that.
I'm glad you guys brought up the fall meet because it's coming up. It's right around the corner at the beginning of October. It was announced a couple of months ago that you guys would be at full capacity in terms of fans coming back and filling the stands. I know that's a big deal for you guys. At Saratoga, we talked about it, how big of a difference it was to have fans back. Can you just talk a little bit about how much that's going to mean to see the place full again?
We have missed our fans so much. It's just not the same. I've had a couple people, especially at Breeders' Cup last year, that said, this is so great. Can we do this every year with this tiny fan base? And I said, no, absolutely not. This is horrible. We need our fans back. So we're really excited to welcome them back. We're still working through what our COVID protocols will be. You know, from the beginning of this really difficult 18 months, we have always put first, foremost, our biggest priority is to make sure that our employees and our patrons are safe. So we're trying to work through what makes the most sense and what other sporting venues that are similarly situated are doing. But I still predict we will be full capacity. We are a sport that, as we've all talked about over and over, we are working in the morning and it's just natural for the horses to be racing in the afternoon. And we're largely outside. Which helps a great deal also. So we are doing all in our power to be sure that we are full capacity and have our fans fully welcome back for October.
Yeah, and that's definitely good news. And even just watching it on TV, it's not the same without the fans in the stands. And you guys, I think you guys have been good about adjusting and being proactive. And I think you guys have been kind of the first to institute policies and protocols among all of the tracks. So I commend you guys for that. You guys had to mix things around and run in July last year, but it was still a great meet. So I appreciate that just as a fan.
Shannon, tradition is obviously a huge part of Keeneland and a huge part of its success. But sometimes, whether it's a baseball team, a football team, a business, or a racetrack, you can't rely just on tradition. You have to keep up with the times. And I think more so than some of your predecessors, you and the team that you've brought in has really looked to change things up a little bit, whether it's the sales or with the racing, and to change things up for the better and to stay with the times. Since you talk about your family goes back to Keeneland in the 1930s, one might think that you would be the last person to want to buck tradition. So where does that come from? Where does that spirit come from and why?
And I think it goes back to wanting the sport and this institution of Keeneland to be the very best it can be. And to do that, we can't keep doing the things that we've always done. We have a lot of tradition and it's one of our serious strengths. And I value tradition. And if you asked my friends and colleagues, they would probably say I'm a traditionalist. But not all of our traditions are good. We've just got to take the best of our traditions and really think about ways to make ourselves better. And I think that goes back to our team. We have a really open dialogue between our team. And I think we've developed this culture where nothing's out of bounds to suggest. We're not afraid to talk about anything. And we're all very comfortable with each other. We trust each other. And that's led, I think, to a lot of the good ideas. And I think there are a lot more to come that I think you all will see.
Yeah, and we're super excited for that. We're super excited for the rest of the sale and the fall meet. And we really appreciate you making some time. Shannon Arvin, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Shannon.
Thanks, guys.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Shannon Arvin will receive a free 1-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
Flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring, backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales. Visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Woodford Thoroughbreds. Woodford had a couple of very nice sales in book one. They had a Pioneer of the Nile filly that went for $500,000 to Michael Hernan, who's an agent for Lael Stables, acting as an agent for Lael Stables. On day two, they had an Uncle Mo colt hit 218, sell for $800,000 to Coolmore, and a Quality Road filly hit 240, go for $525,000. To My Racehorse. They have a big book three coming up this weekend with the likes of sires of Gunrunner, Flatter, Justify, who we talked about before, Street Sense, and City of Light. And some info on some of their book three yearlings. Hip 1738 is a Flatter filly, is a full sister to two other black type Flatter fillies, and the 2-year-old Dr. Jeff, who broke his maiden first out at Saratoga a couple of weeks ago, was favored in the Saratoga special. Hip 1784 is a Justify colt. The grade three winning multiple graded stakes place Bling is My Thing. The 2-year-old King Curlin was second of 11 at Kentucky Downs in his first start this past weekend from that family. And hip 1866 is a Bolt Doro colt out of a half sister to Talk Vuv to Me, who I remember is a very impressive TDN rising star is by Violence. It was by Medallia Doro, so similar family there. So we know the cross works there. And for photos, walking videos, catalog pages, and x-ray reports, you can go to ywoodford.com. So we got the report of mares bred from the Jockey Club last week. This is how we determine the foal crop numbers, the projected foal crop. So the projected foal crop for 2022 based on mares bred this year is 18,700, which is another decline. It's a decline of 500 than the 2021 foal crop estimate, or 2.6%. This is the sixth straight year of decline. It's the lowest figure since 1965, when the foal crop was 18,846, the high water mark, which seems like a bajillion years ago in 1986, was 51,296. Obviously, we're never, ever going to approach those numbers again, but this is obviously a concerning trend for the industry. I think the two biggest trends to follow if you want to know about the health of racing is foal crop and handle. And handle, at least, I think has steadied a bit. You know, it was going down for a long, long time, and now it's at least steadied at around $10 billion, give or take. You would obviously like to see that grow, but at least it's not declining the way it was in the past 20 years. But foal crop continues to go down, and this is something that is obviously going to trickle down to the rest of racing. There's going to be smaller field sizes, which leads to smaller handle. You're going to have fewer owners, and I think that's going to hurt the purse structure eventually. Although, you know, there's some quotes in the story from Elliot Walden about how maybe the purse structure will and the, you know, $100,000 maiden special weights that are all over the place will get this trend to go in the other direction. I don't know about all that. This seems kind of like an irreversible thing, and it's just going to go down, and it's just a matter of how much. But I wonder if Bill has any thoughts.
Yeah, Joe, a lot of thoughts on this. I mean, at 18,700, you're looking at the lowest foal crop since 1965. And I'll say the same thing this year that I would have said in any one of, you know, the 10 prior years. On paper, this makes no sense. I mean, we just talked about horses running for $135,000 maiden races and allowance races at Kentucky Downs. Purses have never been bigger. And if you take purses now versus 20 years ago, I mean, they've gone up. They've just exploded. Thanks largely due to gaming, which is where all the Kentucky Downs money comes from. So, you know, the simple economics here don't make any sense. When the amount of money that is available to horses goes up, you should have more horses. Instead, you get less and less all the time. And, you know, it was interesting what Elliot Walden said, but, you know, maybe these higher purses will start to attract more owners, which will attract more demand for breeding. But, you know, if that were to be the case, why hasn't that happened in the prior years when purses keep going up right now? You know, I don't have the answer to this. I don't know what's going on. The only thing I can think of is I'm sure it's not the top guys that are getting squeezed out, the top breeders. It would seem to me that it's more, you know, like we talk always about the middle market, whether it's at the yearling sales or whatnot. You know, how if you stand a $2,500 sire in Maryland or something, probably really is hard to make a go of something like that. So I would think that's where it's coming from. But the other thing too is the way racing has to adjust to this, I'm not sure it can. We need less racing, because if you don't duck, less racing. Those six horse fields become five horse fields. And then all of a sudden the handle keeps going down and the purses might go down if the handle goes down. And, you know, that's one of the problems the sport has. There's too much racing. And one of the reasons why, you know, it's again, the damned if you do, damned if you don't of the slot machines. The reason why there's too much racing is there's 20 racetracks out there that would be closed if they weren't excuses for having slot borrowers right now. So, you know, let's hope though that it levels off at this number. I mean, this is sustainable, but if we get down to 14,000 foals in 7-8 years from now, something like that is really, really scary.
Yeah. And it's, you know, that is the elephant in the room is that there's too much racing for the foal crops that we have. And there's too many racetracks to, but to your point that, you know, these numbers, you know, and it was a great story that Sue wrote about this, and there were a lot of great quotes in there. The only thing is, I think, you know, most of the quotes were from people like Bill Says, who are at the top end of the game, who aren't really going to feel the squeeze when it comes to declining foal crops. They're mostly guys who, you know, their stallions are all booked, and you know, they breed 100 mares no matter what every single year. It's going to be the smaller state breeders that are going to feel the effects of this with really no business. I thought there was an interesting quote in the story as well from Chauncey Morris about the lack of export and how other countries, I think especially in the Far East, have become more reliant on their own breeding programs as opposed to American bred horses that they would have been exporting, you know, 10, 20 years ago. So I think that's an interesting point as well, that America is no longer, I don't think, the breeding capital of the world. I think, you know, every country that has a sustainable racing product has their own breeding program that they can rely on. But yeah, it like I said, it's eventually going to trickle down, and we already have a problem with field size. You know, this is a blinking red alarm signal that the field sizes are barely over 7 horses per race. And in some cases, you know, if you look at the monthly figures, they're below 7 horses per race, which is completely unsustainable. And this is not going to help that. I wonder if racing really ever addresses these problems in a systemic way. And, you know, not having that centralized body to do so is a real handicap. And I'm not an expert on how to rejuvenate foal crop. Like that's not my department. It's way above my pay grade. But I see some of the quotes that are just kind of, you know, well, this is no big deal. Like, you can't read too much into this. It's not necessarily about this year's foal crop and it being down 500 horses. It's about the trend and the decline. And if handle was going down by this much every year, you would obviously be very, very concerned about it. But, you know, it's something that, like I said, no easy fix, but it's definitely something to monitor. And it's something that's going, it's kind of like a lagging indicator. You know, kind of like we had COVID and we had cases and then hospitalizations and then deaths. The lagging indicator, I think this is one of those things where a couple of years from now, when these foals are on the track, you know, you're going to have 5 horse fields, 5.5, 6 horse fields as an average, and be like, well, why the hell is this happening? Well, not enough foals, too much racing, too many racetracks. And I think the purse thing is a little bit illusory, that now, you know, for now we have a lot of gaming subsidies and we have these boutique meets that can really jack up purses, but overall, like, that's not going to be the trend if foal crop continues to go down. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Legacy is certainly going to be busy over the next week with a huge roster of yearlings going through the September sale. They have 10 going through the ring today as book 2 begins, including a Mendelssohn colt out of a stakes winner and a City of Light colt out of a grade 2 producer. So best of luck to Tommy and Wendy on those horses. And they'll be back with another 7 yearlings on Saturday for the book 3 opener, with 2 more members of the first crop of Mendelssohn, who I expect to sell very well, plus colts by Empire Maker, More Than Ready, and Arrogate. You can check out their group going to book 3 at Barn 9 at Keeneland if you're on the grounds. We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse. every step of the way when it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses. We are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
Not a huge weekend of racing coming up. We do have the Woodbine Mile and the Canadian International card this weekend at Woodbine. I'm going to give a shout out and a pop to them. We also have the Jockey Club Derby and the Jockey Club Oaks this Saturday at Belmont. But we also have the first two-turn races for two-year-olds with the Iroquois Stakes Saturday at Churchill Downs. It's a mile and a 16th race for two-year-olds. And that segues into the announcement that the that suspended trainers will not accrue points with horses on the road to the Kentucky Derby. This was announced last week, which, again, starts this week with the Iroquois Stakes at Churchill Downs. Now, this is obviously has major implications for Bob Baffert. You know, he still has that suspension from Churchill Downs that came down right after the Medina Spirit positive broke. It's going to be litigated and adjudicated and appealed and challenged and all that stuff. We got a little bit of a break from the Bob Baffert lawyer report, but this kind of brings it back to the forefront because, you know, I wonder in this sense that you haven't seen the exodus of horses from Bob Baffert's barn beyond that those first couple of weeks, and Spendthrift sent a couple horses to Todd Pletcher. But overall, I haven't seen, you know, two-year-olds leaving the Bob Baffert barn in droves and going to other trainers. Maybe there have been some behind the scenes, but it seems like he's still pretty loaded with two-year-olds. He just won his 15th Del Mar Futurity a couple of weeks ago with Pinehurst, and he's got a bunch of other pretty good-looking two-year-olds. So I wonder what this means in terms of, you know, his appeal to the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission and the Churchill Downs to maybe try to get this suspension overturned. Because I would think if I had a top two-year-old in the Bob Baffert barn and I saw this news that suspended trainers are not going to be able to have their horses accrue points on the way to the Derby, I would be trying to get my horse the hell out of there. I wonder if this means that they maybe have some owners have some kind of little inkling about this, the way this thing is going to be ruled in the future. Because I really, you know, I would expect after this announcement, people to react in that way. But it doesn't seem like that's happening so far. Bill, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I have plenty. Joe, I think it will happen. You know, first of all, Baffert and his legal team have never challenged the Kentucky Churchill Downs ruling. They challenged NYRA and they won a round in court. But remember, NYRA is different than Churchill because it's privately owned versus maybe not so privately owned or whatever you want to talk to NYRA about. So if this holds up, and then there's got to be an exodus, because as things stand right now, if you have a horse that's coming into the new year, and suppose you want to point him for the San Felipe or something like that, or one of the earlier races, the Robert Lewis. If he's not going to get any Derby points for winning those races, then you have two choices here. You could be incredibly loyal to Baffert, or you can turn the horse over to someone else. And, you know, most of his owners, as you mentioned, have so far been very loyal to him. We've only seen a handful take their horses away. But so far, there hasn't been much to lose by keeping your horses with Baffert, because there's no races right now. Obviously, he's running at Churchill Downs. He was able to run at Saratoga. But I think when it comes into next year, this is a game changer. And, you know, these people that go to the sales and spend $1 million on a yearling, don't buy a yearling to win the Dwyer for Baffert or some race at, or even the Preakness, which you can still run it. They buy the horse to win the Kentucky Derby. That is their goal there. And if they can't even get a horse to take part in the Kentucky Derby, I can't imagine they're going to say, "Hey, Bob, you know, this is a rough deal. We're going to stick by you. And geez, we can't wait to win the Preakness." So the only reason why I think it hasn't happened yet is because there's really no reason to. You know, no one is worth the points you get in the Iroquois, or even the points you get in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, are really not a major factor. You're looking to pick up those points in those big races as a three-year-old, you know, especially races like the Arkansas Derby, Santa Anita Derby, and whatnot. So, you know, look, maybe there is going to be something that's going to come down the pike where Baffert's going to be able to get points for these horses and be able to run the Kentucky Derby. But I don't see it coming. And I think that we are going to see a major exit to this barn.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that there is still a lot of time, but, you know, the suspension came down months ago. And, you know, we really haven't seen, other than that first kind of handful of Spendthrift horses, we haven't seen a ton of horses leave his barn. And, you know, it's just, it's kind of seeing the Keeneland September results and hearing about these million-dollar horses still going to the Bob Baffert barn, it's kind of, I don't know, it seems like people are going to try to ignore this Baffert stuff as long as they possibly can until, you know, it comes to real Derby season and then you really have a decision to make with these horses. But yeah, like you said, I've honestly been pretty surprised by how many owners have stuck by him throughout at least the first 4 or 5 months of this process. And, you know, like I said, like you said, Bill, maybe there are challenges coming. It is interesting that he has not legally challenged the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission, the Churchill suspension, because he has, and he and his lawyers have challenged the NYRA suspensions. And there was some news about that this week as well, where NYRA officially scheduled hearings and issued charges, not just for Bob Baffert, but also for Marcus Vitale, who, if you remember, was able to run a horse at Saratoga and kind of left everybody with egg on their face. Thankfully, the horse didn't win, but just the fact that he even had a horse in the entries, I thought looked bad for everybody involved. So I think that NYRA is trying to get out ahead of that next situation. I'm just going to read the quote here from NYRA's press release. It says, NYRA contends that Mr. Baffert and Mr. Vitale have engaged in conduct that is detrimental to the best interests of the sport of thoroughbred racing, or potentially injurious to the health and safety of horses and riders. Further, as detailed in the respective statements of charges, this conduct warrants revocation or suspension of their right to train horses, enter races, or engage in all racing-related activity at NYRA properties, including Aqueduct, Belmont, and Saratoga. Craig Robertson fired back and said that the injunction that we talked about, the injunction that came down last month, which allowed Baffert to run at Saratoga, and he eventually won a grade one at Saratoga with Gamine, that injunction prevents NYRA from doing any of this stuff until that original suit has concluded. Now, again, I am not a lawyer, but it seems like that should be very clear, whether or not NYRA has the legal authority to do these things while this other suit is potentially still pending. So I don't know where this is going to end up, but it seems like a little bit of a mess right now for Bob Baffert in terms of where he can run, where he can't run. But, you know, if you go by the Keeneland September results, you know, he's still going to be loaded with horses by this time next year. And, you know, people asked, you know, people weren't that into racing, asked me at the time when this stuff with Medina Spirit and Baffert first came down, they said, you know, somebody asked me on TV, they were like, do you think this is a career ending thing for him? And I was just like, no, there are too many people in positions of power and too many, just frankly, very rich people in racing who still have Bob Baffert's back. Now, you might want to say it was a career defining thing with Medina Spirit. He's never going to live that down. But in terms of career ending, no, Bob Baffert's going to continue to train horses and, you know, be at the top levels of the game, maybe not in the Derby. And maybe that lone carrot is enough to take horses and put them into other barns, because other people can win the Derby if you give them a chance. But, you know, he's overall, I think, going to still be a very prominent figure in racing for years and years to come. I think that's been clear from the results of the two-year-olds this year and from the results so far at Keeneland September, with seven-figure yearlings still filling up his barn. We'll see what happens with NYRA, and it is a little bit of a mess, but, you know, Baffert still has a lot of friends in high places in racing, and I think that is going to win out in the long run. We'll see.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, I think he's going to take a major setback. You know, the Bob Baffert of 2022 and 2023 is not going to be the Bob Baffert of, you know, the prior 15 years or whatnot. But the other thing to keep in mind is that in the very worst case scenario, Churchill has only suspended him for 2 years. So if he can't run in the 22 and 23 Derby, and maybe also with NYRA's thing, can't run in the 22-23 Belmont either, or the 22-23 Travers, I think he'll have a good stable. I think he'll have horses that win a lot of important races around the country. I don't think it'll be as quite tilted towards the three-year-old colts as it has been in the past. But as soon as he's back and cleared, you know, people still want to win the Kentucky Derby more than anything else in this sport. And who is the guy, no matter what has happened to him, forget about Ben Matheson, Medina Spirit, et cetera, who is the guy who is most likely to get your horse into the winner's circle of the Kentucky Derby? That's going to be Bob Baffert again when this is all said and done. You know, this is not a lifetime ban. I mean, Jorge Navarro and Jason Service will never train a racehorse again the rest of their lives. I would go, you know, I would bet all the money I have in the world on that. Bob Baffert is going to continue to train, and I think his career will have a major setback in a readjustment period. But I don't think you need to shed too many tears.
No, definitely not. And also the thing about him being most likely to train a Kentucky Derby winner, I think that that is a self-perpetuating thing where he gets the best horses because people think that he's more likely to win the Derby than anybody else. Statistically, he is, but I think a lot of it has to do with the stock that he has in his barn. I think that, you know, it just becomes a self-perpetuating thing where he just gets more and more and more and more high-priced horses, has more and more chances, and then is more and more likely to win the Derby, which reinforces the perception that, oh, Bob Baffert's got the magic touch to win the Kentucky Derby, when I think if you give, you know, at least half of the top-level trainers in this country those same horses, they could probably do the same thing. But I guess we're going to find out. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
The World's Yearling Sale. Make plans for the Keeneland September Yearling Sale, September 13th through the 24th. Visit theworldsyearlingsale.com to learn more.
Just wanted to mention this real quick before we sign off, because there was another sentence that came down in the FBI indictments. Scott Mangini was a guy who was selling alleged PEDs and got sentenced to 18 months. That seems to be the standard sentence for a lot of these lower level actors, and this thing was 18 months. I think two other people have gotten that sentence. So far, we're obviously waiting to see what the sentences are for Jorge Navarro and, you know, maybe eventually Jason Service if he's found guilty. But T.D. Thorne wrote about this in his Week in Review. He's good at like going through these court documents and finding the most interesting tidbits. But it was actually a little dark comedy, I thought, in some of the stuff that was happening in Scott Mangini's sentences, where he's still arguing, even as he's accepting his sentence and pleading guilty, he's still arguing that he wasn't technically selling PEDs, and he wasn't, you know, he's selling more placebos or nutrient pills or these vague kind of healthy things that I think a lot of people take these supplements, you know, thinking that it'll make them have a six pack or, you know, you know, gain muscle or any of this stuff. That's kind of was his argument, that you go into GNC and all these things, all these bottles of pills have these wild claims and you can't reasonably expect them to make you into an Olympic bodybuilder overnight. But the government came back at him and was basically like, well, have you looked at the names of some of the stuff that you were selling on your website? And I'll just read a couple for you. Blood building explosion, pre-race explosion, growth factor 5,000. Horsepower, equine growth hormone, numb it, purple pain injection, plug it, bleeder injection, blast off, breather injection. One product was called white lightning and was described as something that would increase stamina and performance in races, greyhounds, and camels. So for the camel racing fans out there, I think you got to clean up your sport as well. Can't be racing that's cleaning itself up. But no, I mean, and many of the products were stamped as will not test. So it's a kind of a hard argument to make when you're marketing things like that, that this was not intended for PED sales. So it was one of those, another one of these parts of the story that was funny, but it's not funny. And it really underscored for me, at least, what we talked about last week, where when these indictments came down, you thought, you know, this was kind of like a, you know, criminal genius masterminded plot. And then the more and more you hear about it, you think this was a real two-bit operation. And it's pretty unfortunate that a two-bit operation like this was able to game the racing industry for years and years and years. But it was, you know, darkly funny to read those marketing materials for these drugs. Bill, what do you think?
Yeah, and I have one other additional thought. I mean, first of all, you're right. The whole thing was just so patently ridiculous. You know, it's like, you know, you don't know whether to laugh or cry. But one thing, it appeared to me, and from what T.D., who did a very good job, as always, with the story, was that the lawyer kind of wanted Mangini to walk off the prison with his reputation as intact as possible. And I'm wondering, think about this. So Navarro Service, they have to have a license to train. The vets that have been indicted, I'm sure they have to have some sort of license as well. Mangini was a guy who had these websites, you know, buy my stuff and your horse will run faster.com, et cetera. I don't know if something like that is regulated by any, who would be in charge of that? I'm wondering if this guy is already thinking, maybe this is a wild thought, but maybe he's going to serve his 18 years. See, 18 years, I wish it was 18 years, is 18 months. And then the day he gets out of prison is going to just go back to selling the stuff online. You know, maybe he's not stupid enough to sell illegal stuff anymore, but to sell these placebos and these, you know, kind of things that are a little bit more innocuous. So, you know, as much as that would leave a bad taste in your mouth, I'm not so sure you could keep a guy like this out of doing what he does. I mean, who would be able to step up and say, Scott Mangini, you can never again sell horse and veterinary products online?
I don't know. Maybe the FDA, because I think that was one of the main crimes, was that these were non-FDA regulated, you know, meds that they were synthesizing allegedly and selling. Well, it's not alleged again in this case. But yeah, I love that he wanted to keep his reputation intact. There's one thing I know about Scott Mangini, and I don't know anything. It's that he is a straight shooter. He's a guy. He's a guy with integrity, and yeah, I don't know. I don't think that reputation, if he had that, is gonna survive these 18 months and whatever he gets out. But now we're getting these little trickles, these little drips of news and sentencing coming down. So we're just waiting for those big fish to potentially be reeled in. And it seems like now we're at least on our way. And guys, maybe in this business, won't be buying Blood Builder Explosion 5000 Lightning anymore in the future. One can hope. All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. Reminder that the Keeneland September sale is going on now. Book 2 starts in a couple of minutes, and the sale runs through next Friday, September 24th. You can learn more and view the catalog at theworldsyearlingsale.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, Gabby Gaudette for jumping in. Gabby and Christina Bosanakis have the new podcast on TDN called Let's Talk. Check it out. Check the first episode out now. The second episode is on deck soon. I also want to thank our producer, Patty Wolf, our Green Group guest of the week, Shannon Arvin, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak. No longer. Katie Ritz. Katie got married over the past couple of weeks. Congratulations, Katie. We're very, very happy for you guys. Also want to thank our editors, Ali LaRocca, Anthony LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. We will see you next week, hopefully, back in the studio.